And so here we are at last. It's time for us to conclude our extraordinary episode by episode analysis of a film that is, like all films, not episodic in its nature. It's just one film that you watch the whole way through. But not us. On the Napoleon Movie Quarter Hourly, we've been doing it in slightly more detail, trying to understand the decisions taken by the filmmakers as they massacre the various bits of the 1792 to 1815 period. Well, it's a great pleasure that I, Alexander Stevenson, have been joined for the 10th time by James Topham, an actual screenwriter. James, you know a thing or two about screenwriting.
Alex, it is a joy to be here. Can't believe we made it all the way to the final 15 minutes. And I must say, I'm feeling pretty bittersweet about it all. You know, it's obviously sweet because watching Napoleon in intensive 15-minute increments with you and then podcasting about it has been something of an ordeal. And now it's finally over. And bitter because I'm bitter that you made me do it.
Well, James, I would say that the word that springs to mind for me is disappointing. because we've spent the whole time dissing this movie. And appointing, because I'm delighted to appoint you as the official Napoleonic Quarterly screenwriting expert in perpetuity.
Well, that's very kind of you, Alex. That's very kind.
That's right.
Indeed.
So here we are, James. We've got to the 2.25-hour mark in the theatrical version, of course, and that is slightly unfortunate, it has to be said, because on reflection, of course, maybe we should have waited until the 4-hour cut was released, seeing as that's what everybody would be watching if they happened to be listening along. So,
I mean, arguably no one has ever asked for this podcast, Alex, but I can't imagine that they'll be asking for it when a completely different version is released.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good for morale. Okay, so we've basically got, I think, about 13, 14 minutes of screen time left before the credits roll. And as has been stated many times, you'd seen the film before, you were in the cinema, you were even awake for this 15 minutes. I hadn't watched it until the last few days. And boy, oh boy, we've got some actual stuff to talk about here in this last 15 minutes. So, James, over to you.
There's something serious happening. So we open as we left off last time with French troops cascading towards the British lines, and that wonderful mouth of Rupert Everett that we've talked about before. He says in a sort of twisted grimace, "Prepare to receive cavalry."
I'm trying to do it. Prepare to receive cavalry, but it doesn't quite work. You just have to be Rupert Everett. He's such a good cast as Wellington.
He is definitely a good casting cast. "We can't be beat," he says, as Wellington, "or what will they say in England?" And, you know, it's funny that Wellington, though he's only been in the film for about 10 minutes, seemed to have a much clearer motivation and rationale for what he's doing than Napoleon, who we've been watching for hours.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And there is something to it, the idea that basically embarrassment, social embarrassment, as a driver of extreme behaviour, even to heroism, that figures, I think. That makes sense as a British person myself.
Do you feel that Wellington is the person you empathise with most?
Hang on, I'm going to have to give that some thought. No, because he's so entitled. And I, for one, am not entitled because I went to a comprehensive, unlike some of the individuals in the film Saltburn.
Didn't you grow up in a mansion, Alex?
No, look, James, come on. The mansion where my... No, come on. The listeners don't need to know about... Look, it was a very little mansion.
It was a mini Saltburn.
It was a desperate situation. My parents were destitute, and they'd lost...
In many ways, Alex, you're not unlike the sinister butler from the 2023 motion picture Saltburn, in that you kind of haunted that mansion as a figure of deep concern to the people who actually live there. Would that be fair to say?
I dream of it still. And the funny thing is, it was actually bought by Wellington. Did you know that? Did you know?
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah, it actually was. But just to be clear, listeners, this was not a position of financial privilege. It was a desperate situation where, having lost their semi-detached house, my parents had no choice but to take employment managing and looking after a small mansion, basically.
Look, Alex. I don't want to rake up old, old wounds for you. Look, let's dive back into Waterloo because something quite remarkable is happening. Something that could not possibly have happened on the field of battle before, prior to this moment, given the amount of attention that's given to it by the filmmakers. The English shout to each other, "Form square." Now, we haven't seen squares before in any of the battles hitherto, and the French soldiers are completely confounded by it. Squares, Alex. You're the historical man. Yeah, no, tell me about squares.
Well, James, if you imagine, say you were designing a computer game which simulated the battles of the Napoleonic period, one thing you could do with your infantry regiments when you click on them is you could click, there's a form square option.
Well, Alex, I would be constantly forming squares because
it's a very sensible thing to do.
It's very successful in terms of Waterloo. The French keep shouting, "We can't break through. This is impossible. The square thing is truly defeating us."
Yes.
They're in real terrible trouble, Alex.
Yes, James, that's absolutely the case. If only the Battle of the Pyramids had been depicted as it actually was. That basically involved the forming of lots of squares and the Mamelukes being similarly scuppered. Sadly, as Napoleon historical advisor Michael Proas will reveal in a forthcoming bonus episode of the Napoleonic Quarterly, because they were filming the Battle of the Pyramids on Malta, and they didn't have the horses on Malta, so they couldn't do it. So they had to shoot at the pyramids instead. That's an exclusive.
That's big news.
Yeah,
that's big news.
Anyway, yeah, squares, boya, but they are extremely good. If you're up against cavalry, then they are just the ticket.
And things are looking very bad for Napoleon, I guess, because of the square business. But also, we know this from a filmmaking perspective because a lone male voice starts on the soundtrack with a sort of warbling death knoll.
Yeah, I know. What words is he actually singing?
Oh, no, it's bad for Napoleon. Don't know, it's not in English.
Yeah, that's definitely
not in French,
what he's
either.
Saying there.
and sure enough, Alex, this presentiment of doom is not wrong because Napoleon is given the word that the ticking Blücher has finally ticked down to zero. The Prussians have arrived on the horizon and Napoleon's expression is sort of like, "Oh, this is hard work." And he rides into battle.
Yeah, which is interesting and not actually what happened, but the facial expression is plausible. That's very plausible, actually. But I suppose Ridley Scott would simply have felt that the protagonist had to roll the dice, which involved including his own sort of bid for, I guess, risking his own personal safety. It was all on the line for Napoleon. I'm so down now at this stage of our project that I'm assuming that that's what the filmmakers are doing. Would you say that's about right?
No, you're assuming good, assuming well, I think. Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think everything is on the line and Napoleon feels like it's just no good for Napoleon to be sat on the sidelines for this final moment. History check.
I've got the story
it's
of...
It's just in.
It's our only historical source being used for this mini podcast project, The Story of Napoleon, published 1968 by L. Ducard Peach. It's a children's Ladybird adventure from history book. It says that Napoleon attacked Wellington's position with cavalry and infantry. So maybe it was Napoleon by himself going for it. You know, that's plausible.
But both on a horse and with a cannon.
It was towards evening when the Prussians reached the battlefield. Their arrival made victory certain.
It didn't feel like evening, did it? But anyway, it doesn't matter. I think the important thing for me is that Napoleon gives a final brief address to some of his troops. You know, we've been talking a lot about Napoleon's relationship with his men. And he says, "Look, you're the heroes of Austerlitz. You know, let's do this thing one more time. Of course, unlike at Austerlitz, Waterloo wasn't fought on a massive ice lake, and so he wasn't able to pull the same trick twice.
If only.
And so the final charge is on, but the British have got another powerful battlefield strategy up their sleeve, Alex, a formation that they call shoulder-to-shoulder, form a line. That's what they shout, shoulder-to-shoulder, form a line.
It's a great ruse.
Look, and that line forming is very effective, very effective. The French charge goes badly. One poor soldier who is running into battle with nothing more than a drum gets his head shot off. It's not good for the French.
It's not going well for him, yeah.
Certainly not for that French drummer boy. I think I'd say probably from a screenwriting perspective at this stage, and I know I've said this before with the battles in the film, it feels like it sort of lacks a kind of narrative. It's not clear why things are happening and for what reason they're being done or what their implications are. And I'll give you an example of this. It seems to all intents and purposes that the French assault is going very badly and the Prussians come over the horizon, Wellington seems incredibly relieved, right? He says, thank God.
He does.
And I'm a bit like, well, you're square and your shoulder-to-shoulder line thing seems to be going very well. You should have a bit more confidence in yourself.
Yeah, I think of all of the battlefield portrayals, this felt like the biggest head scratcher, actually, because it wouldn't have required much to have had a go at, I don't know, basically Napoleon doing better, that shoulder to shoulder line being pressed by the young guard, the old guard, the Imperial Guard, who, by the way, are not a character collectively in this film, and they really ought to have been. So it's a real shame that Napoleon wasn't doing much better at that stage. There was no reason why the stakes couldn't have been raised just that little bit higher. It's a shame.
You want the Prussians to be the elves, Alex, don't you? You want all to be, in trouble with the Fellowship, and then the elves come over the hill.
Oh, sorry, I was thinking of Christmas. I was really confused.
The elves on the shelves.
Bringing the presents of... they're bringing their military presents.
Well, quite. So one nice touch before Waterloo ends is that we get a brief return of the sniper who was so sorely derided by you last week, Alex, and who, despite very clear orders to the contrary by Wellington, does take a shot at Napoleon.
He just can't help himself, can he? He's like...
He has to take that shot. I've got the shot, he says. I've got the shot. He doesn't, but that's certainly the impression that he gives. And I don't know if there could be anything more symbolic than this, Alex. The sniper's shot takes a chunk out of Napoleon's iconic hat, which will do no favours for his famed silhouette.
No, they really dwelled on that, didn't they, for a good half second, full second. Yeah, he's got a hole in his hat.
And Joaquin Phoenix does a great expression, a bit like, oh, what's happened to my hat? But look, the hat thing signals the end for Napoleon. He concedes the battle with a raised sword. And Rupert Everett, who, as we know, does 95% of his acting with his mouth, twitches his lips a couple of times in response. It's great lip twitching. At one point, his lips go entirely vertical from their normal horizontal position.
Wait, do you mean down? Do you mean?
No. I mean entirely a vertical line. They somehow compress into each other.
Oh, wow. Wow. Right. All right. Okay.
and he says, I've got to say, a pronunciation that is absolutely baffling at this point. The battle is mine. Nope. There will be an end to the wear. Which is, I mean, his voice has been weird, but there will be an end to the wear.
He's paying someone who's posh, isn't he? That's how it goes.
Yeah, he is. And you used to live in his house.
Apparently, yeah. So, right, well.
Napoleon has been... So the battle ends. The battle ends and Napoleon has been taken prisoner and he's being held on Wellington's ship, I assume.
No, it's not Wellington's ship. It's just a ship, isn't it? In the Royal Navy. Come on.
Well, look, and he's... Napoleon's holding for, he's been reduced to the position of holding forth on his military brilliance to a group of children. And Wellington arrives, who seems to have never been on a ship before in his life. He bangs his head multiple times on its beams. And then he comes into the room that Napoleon is eating his breakfast in.
James, you've skipped past the advice he was giving to the children.
Oh, and what was that advice?
It was all about mistakes, wasn't it? It was about his brilliance was one thing, but he couldn't stop others making errors. He couldn't stop them making failures. He blamed the marshals, basically. And his advice to the children was, make sure when you're me, you get a better marshalate. And there's all the children are listening impassively, apart from one on the right-hand side of the screen, who is nodding away furiously and doing a great job and clearly, potentially, has maybe one of the first Napoleon complexes.
Yeah, that's where it began. That's where the Napoleon complex began, yeah. In that very room. It's very interesting. He says he seems to be either unaware of the true reason for his defeat, or something's happened that the filmmakers haven't shown us that leads us to believe that Napoleon's downfall was caused by other people's mistakes. That's certainly not something that's been established in the film.
Yeah, I haven't read the book. There's a book by somebody called Stephen about Waterloo, how the French think they won
somebody
Waterloo.
Somebody called Stephen.
Yeah, I can't remember what it's called. How the French think they won Waterloo. How the French won Waterloo, or think they did, is by Stephen Clark. I'd love to get him on the podcast. It was published a while ago, and it's about this sort of this denial. Here's the blurb. I'm looking at it now. The denial started with Napoleon himself, who spent the rest of his life trying to prove that Waterloo wasn't a defeat or wasn't his fault, blah, 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 blah. And so, that's probably got something to do with it, hasn't it? That they're actually... showing that in his approach here.
Historically accurate. One thing that I question from a historical accuracy perspective, Alex, is this room that he's in. So this room is massive. The floor is tiled. It's whitewashed. What did you make of that, Alex? That did not look like a room on a boat to me.
Well, don't say boat for a start.
Okay.
I think if you Google Great Cabin HMS Victory, then you'll see that Nelson's amazing Great Cabin at the back of the boat, or as we non-lubbers say, the stern of the ship.
Oh my God,
it's it, isn't it?
It's actually that. Yeah. That is a very...
How about that?
Well... My goodness.
So this film continues to surprise us, doesn't it? It wrong-foots us all the time.
A remarkable reconstruction. I urge all our listeners to take a look
at that. That's good, isn't it?
But what is not good, he said, segueing beautifully, is Napoleon's belief that he will be retiring happily somewhere in Britain after his defeat. The Cotswolds, maybe. Now, that's a very American tourist thing, isn't it? A love of the Cotswolds. I don't think I could tell you where the Cotswolds are, Alex. I've got absolutely no idea, but Americans love them.
I've deliberately never learned where the Cotswolds are. And this is so that because my grandparents lived in the middle of the Cotswolds, and I never wanted to fully understand the geography because I preferred having a hazy misunderstanding of roughly where it was in the United Kingdom.
It was sort of like Narnia to you.
It was a bit. In the village where my grandparents lived, I deliberately avoided working out which way was north so I could be confused. And even when I learned to drive, I continued to succeed in this navigational misconceit.
That's very interesting. I feel like we're unpeeling a lot of the layers of the onion that is Alexander Stevenson this episode.
And now they're dead. And do I look at the map now?
No. You'll never know where the Cotswolds are in memory of them.
It's a tricky one. So far, I haven't... I still don't know. I still don't know where North is in the Cotswolds.
Well, It doesn't matter because Napoleon's not going there. Wellington discloses to him that it's no good. The British public won't wear it. And Napoleon's going to be sent to St. Helena and into exile.
So, James, very keen to ask you about what you something you mentioned in the last episode, the idea of Wellington as a late stage antagonist. And clearly now you see his scene, his speech at the Congress of Vienna as the beginning of that story. Then he's got Waterloo itself as the middle, and then this scene on board HMS Billy Ruffian is the end, isn't it? Where he gets his, or he gets to give Napoleon his comeuppance. Could you say something about this late stage antagonist thing a bit more as it's basically wrapped up now?
Yeah. So look, he's like what we said about the late stage antagonist is that he's often the kind of mirror image of your protagonist, right? And he's, I think, portrayed here as having a very different point of view to Napoleon that I think illuminates maybe where Napoleon's got to in his journey, right? So Wellington says of St. Helena, you know, it's this tiny place. You're going to be, you know, at the beck and call of the governor there. It's a little rock. Wellington can't think of anything worse than this kind of boring place 1,000 miles off the African coast. But actually, I think quite interesting, Napoleon's seems sort of relieved about it. He seems sort of almost happy to be for his struggles to have come to an end. I don't know if that's something that you picked up from Joaquin Phoenix's performance, which obviously is sometimes difficult to pass.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? It's not the first time that somebody has unexpectedly laughed in this film.
Yeah. Napoleon gives one of his laughs followed by serious faces.
Yeah. And so I wonder, is he developing his understanding to the same level of depth that Josephine had, a sort of detachment or semi-detachment from reality born of bitter experience, mirroring Josephine's experience in the revolutionary days in the Bastille, and now Napoleon's been through the ringer as Emperor of France?
Yeah. Well, maybe it's a detachment, but maybe it's also a kind of a letting go of his worldly ambitions, right? You know, I think we talked a lot about wants and needs, didn't we, at the beginning of the film? Do you know what I mean? And I think his want all throughout has been to be the emperor, right? To have this kind of Alexander-esque kind of conquering of the world, to bestride the world. And now he's come to the point where that is no longer possible for him. And maybe he's accepting of that. And what's the alternative life to that? I think we might see as he goes to St. Helena.
Let's do it, because for me, this is... And there's been a few ropey 15-minute sections, but this little... It's almost like a 10-minute short... A little film that's chucked on the end of the film that we've just been watching, where all of a sudden it gets quite arty and possibly even almost quite good.
It's sort of interesting, isn't
yes,
it? And it's interesting that you mentioned Josephine, because of course, as Napoleon sails off to St. Helena, Josephine comes back. We hear her in voiceover, sort of a ghost Josephine, as it were, a ghostophine. And it's really interesting. It's a little soliloquy which ends with, "Come to me next time I will be emperor, and you will do exactly as I say." Now, what do you think about that, Alex? That's an interesting turn, isn't it?
It's quite the turn. It's quite the baffling turn. Well, we'd seen the in that other interesting 15 minutes of this film about their relationship that the power dynamic between them switched, didn't it? She had been the one grovelling one moment, and then later on she's able to turn the tables, and all of a sudden he's the one grovelling to her. And so they've been through those many years of tortured existence with her stuck at Malmaison. And now she is the one with the ascendancy in their relationship, because it doesn't matter that she's actually dead. She continues to exist in Napoleon's mind. He continues to have those conversations with her with her presence. He's communing with her spirit. And just as he was able to correspond with her interminably and at length during the boring middle act when he was off in Russia, he just keeps doing it, doesn't he? It doesn't matter that she's dead. It doesn't matter that she's gone. She remains a real presence in his life and in his consciousness in these lonely final days.
And like you said, that's really fascinating, Alex. And like you said, it's kind of like the power dynamic is flipped, right? It's almost as though all the things that he's done and the things he did that left her behind, do you know what I mean? He had to have an heir. He had to be seen as an emperor that didn't have this kind of appendage to him, and therefore he had to let her go. All of those things that meant that he had to hold on to the power have sort of leaked away, and now he's in this position where he's supplicant to her again.
Yeah, exactly. As she said, you're nothing without me.
You're nothing without me. It turns out that was a key line, I think. And here we see exactly that, right? He's been without her now, and he's been reduced to nothing. So Napoleon in St. Helena goes to seed slowly. You know, he finds a fly in his wine.
Oh, the fly! What is going on with the fly? All of a sudden, we're in art school territory here.
And he picks it out. He has a good look at it. It's a massive fly. In all fairness, he's probably thinking this is a big fly.
Why? He's thinking, why did the studio not come up with a smaller prop?
Yeah, but his thoughts are all on Josephine, and I guess he's reviewing his previous exploits. He briefly has an argument with some children about whether he was the one who burnt Moscow or whether the Russians did it. He's significantly bested by those children.
The children are running rings around him, but he is in a post-truth mode, and it doesn't matter what they are claiming in terms of actually stating reality to him. He's going to insist on his version of events, and then when they disagree, he's going to throw grapes at them, but in a sort of playful, I don't necessarily care that much sort of way. He's accepting that he's pushing his luck with his constant attempts at making the truth obfuscated, I suppose.
Yeah. No, that's right. He's losing care for these kind of big world shattering events. It feels like it sort of doesn't matter to him as much as it once did.
James, did you think the grapes were an echo of the grape shot that killed the horse? That the grape shot that was provided to his mother early on in the film.
Frankly, Alex, no. Yeah, no. I'm sure that was right. And I'm sure him shooting those grapes were very much like his ability to position a cannon perfectly.
Yeah, they have wooden swords. All he has is grapes. It's not much. But he does what he can with them.
Oh, there's something in that, I think, Alex. That's pretty deep.
That's very charitable of you.
Look, this battle between grape and wooden swords is going to turn out to be the last of Napoleon's great battles, because as Josephine speaks to him from the afterlife, telling him that he should come to her and they should try it all over again. Very interesting. Don't know what the film's saying there.
Napoleon II.
The afterlife. Yeah. The camera is positioned behind him, and he sort of slides off his chair to the side.
This is the final shot of the film, and it's that iconic hat seen from the back, and it's
without the hole in it.
Yeah, the hole has been
fully formed hat. He's obviously got a new one.
And he conks out, doesn't he? He keels over. He slowly falls to the left-hand side. And after what was genuinely, I think, building to be a really good finish, you just finish with this very silly shot, which is absurd.
Do you think it was a bit anticlimactic?
It made me laugh out loud. And given that I'd been contemplating the inevitability of death because of the fly and all of the themes going on, it got me in a good place. And then bonk, the end.
But you say the end, but we're not quite there yet, Alex, because the true hero of this film, the on-screen title, has a little bit more to tell us. We get a list of Napoleon's battles, and we learn that over 3 million people were killed during his reign. And it feels sometimes, Alex, like I watched every single one of those deaths during this film. And then we learn Napoleon's last words, which were France, Army, Josephine. The three, one might say, great themes of his life. Now, of course, anyone watching the film will have noted that the last words before him dying on screen were actually go, go play, as he threw some grapes at those girls. But let's not split hairs. The key is that the last word on screen, as everything else fades away, is, I think, what the film would posit was the most important thing in Napoleon's life, Josephine. And that's it. That's the end.
Well, is this a film about Napoleon and Josephine? I think it might have been better if it was focused even more on that relationship, but I suppose we should probably take stock in general terms in a further episode that considers the... Of course, technically, the film isn't over. We've got a few 7 or 8 minutes of credits to cover off, haven't we? So maybe we do need to reconvene for a final episode in this little mini project, mini series, to chew over our assessment overall then.
I suppose we could speak in more general terms as the credits roll. I suppose I can force myself to do one more episode, Alex.
One more episode. What I think was a shame is that we didn't see more of the of France's former foreign minister, Charles-Maurice de Talleyrand, de Périgord, whatever his name is, Talleyrand, played by...
Do you mean the sinister butler from the 2023 motion picture Saltburn?
I do, James. I don't know why you keep going on about this film Saltburn. Is it any good?
Oh, you should really watch it, Alex.
Saltburn, really? I mean, it's got nothing to do with the Napoleonic period, but seeing as you've mentioned it so much, maybe I'll give it a try.
Well, Alex, I suppose there's nothing left for me to say than I've really enjoyed our time together, as I always do. And
because by forming square, the battle will be bad and there will be an end to the war.